You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. It's hot, but it's pretty out there, Don.
It's clear. It's hot. It's not as hot as it was a couple days ago. So here we are looking at a temperature today, July 10th, 2024, as Lois and I prepare this for broadcast on July 11th, 2024. It's going to be 105 today. And we're going, oh, good. It's not as hot as it was on Saturday. That's where we're
at. You know, when people, I think if we were trying to discourage people from moving here, you know, we always talk about how wonderful it is. And I'm afraid we're going to get too big. But, you know, we talk about this. We came down. It's a relief that it's so cool. It's only 105. Yeah, okay, going to move here.
Yesterday wasn't too bad. We had an epic week of heat here in the Sacramento Valley with the high temperature in Davis of 111 degrees on Saturday and nearly up there on Sunday. And very, very, very low humidity, obviously, but still those kind of temperatures are quite something. And we're not going to be seeing quite as hot, but they do have an excessive heat warning in effect from today, July 10 through July 12. So today, the day before the broadcast, 105, tonight's low temperature, 65 degrees, clear, no clouds anywhere for like the next week at least, if not the next 3 months. Thursday, the day of the broadcast, it will be apparently 109 degrees in Davis, which will be unpleasant, but Thursday night will cool down to 67 degrees. Look at that, a 40 degree temperature swing. Friday will be 105 degrees. Friday night, 65 degrees, again, clear. Saturday, cooling to 98 degrees. There we go, below 100. Saturday night, 61 degrees. And Sunday, sunny and 93 degrees, which for the record is our average high temperature in the month of July here in Davis. So Sunday will be average, 93 degrees and sunny. And Sunday night, 58 degrees, cooling off nicely with a delta breeze. Monday, 93 degrees. Monday night, 58 degrees. Tuesday, 93 degrees, and so forth. With some heating in the long-range forecast, looking at Weather Underground, they're going out and saying we're going to be 97, 98 by the end of next week. But for the first part of next week, cooler temperatures. It has been very high from a gardening standpoint. I want to mention this right up front at the beginning of the show. Very high evapotranspiration rate here in the Sacramento Valley for the last 8 to 9 days. We generally average about 0.25 to 0.28 inch. In other words, about a quarter inch plus of water use on an individual day. That's the ET rate we talk about a lot here on the show. On the second, it was 0.37. 0.25 to 0.37 is a pretty big difference there. The day before that was 0.33. The next day was 0.35. And then the 4th of July was 0.3. 5th of July was 0.3. 6th was 0.29. 7th, 0.29. So we have been running 20% plus above average water use by plants based on the measured evapotranspiration rate. That's a really, really, really important data point at the moment. We're spending a lot of time already just 2-3 days after that extreme heat of the weekend, looking at sample after sample after sample by pictures sent to us or samples brought into the nursery of plants that were affected by the heat and, of course, by watering issues. The watering issues have become critical because the plants' water needs are now 20 to 30% higher than average at the time of year that we're at our very highest water use. So Distribution of water supplies has been a problem. Drip systems not running long enough to make a solid wet zone, not running them long enough at all in most cases, of course. Just inadequate depth of watering, inadequate distribution of watering. We talk about those things all the time, but those are the cause of many of the samples, the symptoms of many of the samples that we're looking at every day right now. And I've told the staff, you know, as we always like to say on this show, today's weather is next week's problems. So we're almost.
I do not want a t-shirt with that on it.
Yeah, I think that's a great t-shirt. Great slogan. Today's weather is next week's problems. Gardeners would understand it right away because what we're seeing now is the early stages of symptoms of leaf scorch, sunburn on fruit, withering along the edges of leaves. And what's interesting is how differently plants react to heat and drought stress. Some of them just kind of scorch. If you have a privet or a Pittosporum tobira, you know, a waxy leaf, shiny leaf, thick leafed plant, and it gets drought stressed and that waxy coating thins out, you just get literally sunburn on the leaf. You can explain it. I can take the leaf and go, this is how it was facing towards the west or the southwest. And that's why that part of the leaf is being burned. Other plants, if they get drought stressed, interior leaves yellow and drop. Or a new growth on something really soft and herbaceous like a tomato plant or a dahlia or something was withered very rapidly at the top. The new growth is affected. A lot of plants, it's the edge of the leaf desiccating inward. And those are the ones that are fun. It's like a maple is a really good example. People bring me some leaves and I can take a Sharpie and go, here was the first time it ran out of water. It was the second time it ran out of water. I can draw trace right along the line of damage on the leaf back from that point of insufficient irrigation. Then it got watered, maybe not quite enough, but it got watered enough to stop that damage, and it happened again. So plants do vary as to how they respond to high temperature, and particularly the combination of high temperature and either moderate or, of course, severe drought stress. Now, I've seen some pictures sent to us recently of severe drought stress. That one's pretty easy to explain. But when different plants in your yard have these different reactions to the extreme temperatures and the irrigation problems, it can be challenging to understand.
And it also is challenging because you're not the plant. You're not the one who's sitting out there going, okay, the sun's over here and it's on me for 6 hours. Okay, now the sun's going up behind that tree. Whereas the plant 20 feet away might be going, oh, I'm in the shade. Oh, here comes the sun. It's 2 hours and now here I'm back in the shade. And you're thinking, oh, they're both in the sun. Well, yes, but there's difference between 2 hours of sun and 6 hours of sun.
Right. The highest temperature is that 111 degree temperature was right as we were closing up our nursery, 5 to 6 p.m. And the humidity at that point was probably less than 10%. At our garden center on that day, we watered three times. The smaller plants needed it three times. The bigger plants, one thorough soaking for a 15-gallon container was sufficient. 5-gallon containers, it depended on how root bound they were, what kind of soil they're in. So I can't even give you an absolute guideline of water your container plants once and you'll be fine. It really depends on the condition of the plant. So let's do our public service announcement stuff first. KDRT is community radio. That means we rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, if you like all the different programming here at KDRT, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And while you're over there, you will find all kinds of great programming. We now have two or three new shows as of about 2 months ago, and one that just started, In the Key of Folk, offers music that will keep you humming or dancing along, perhaps both. The focus is on traditional and current folk music, Americana, bluegrass, Celtic, Nordic, and Spanish infusions, wherever my travels and interests take me, says DJ or programmer Karen. There we go, Karen. In addition, the music of contradance, an American folk tradition that came with English and other settlers, will often be threaded through the hour. Don't know it? You can check it out. Right now, it's Wednesdays running from
2 to 3.
Thank you. 2 to 3 p.m. on Wednesdays. Almost all the programming here at KDRT rebroadcasts at some point during the week. So for the rebroadcast schedule, you can click on the schedule guide. You can also click on the podcast link and have it download right into your computer. In the Key of Folk, new programming here at KDRT. Visitors to the UC Davis Arboretum are experiencing a little bit of shock right now. You head on over there. Where's the creek?
Let's be specific about this. This is a channel that used to be part of Pewter Creek, has not been running for years and years and years. But it's been there, and there's been water in it and ducks and stuff. And they're doing some work now to renovate parts of it. So parts of the creek bed are dry. Other parts are not. So people who are concerned about, well, what's happened to all the ducks? Well, they flew down to the other part they're over there.
Yeah, this is, they're increasing stormwater capacity. They're improving wetland and riparian habitat. They're adding pumps and weirs for water circulation, which has really been a missing element at that creek for a long time. Concrete edges are being replaced with gently sloped banks of native vegetation. There's a lot of information, but visitors are kind of startled to walk over to their favorite part of the Arboretum and see what looks like bare soil. So if you have questions about the Arboretum Waterway Flood Protection and Habitat Enhancement that's underway as we speak, head on over to arboretum.ucdavis.edu. You'll find a link to the waterway, and there's a whole FAQs, frequently asked questions segment there. What's happened to the wildlife? What are they doing? How long is it going to take? Where are the detours and all that kind of thing? You can still walk all around the Arboretum. You'll just occasionally you'll have to go on a different path than you're used to. This will be a major, major improvement, and lots of interesting new landscaping going in. So I'd say a year or two from now, it'll be really, really impressive. And the gardens are all still there, and the Arboretum is all still open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But if you've got questions, arboretum.ucdavis.edu.
So I want to give you a heads up. We won't talk about it a lot, but save the date. Saturday, August 3rd, 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. is the Harvest Day 2024. And that is over at the Fair Oaks Horticultural Center. And we'll talk more about that later, because that's a ways in the way.
It's a big deal. Lots of people, lots of experts over there to answer questions. And you can look at the amazing display garden that shows ways to train fruit trees and grow vegetables in small backyards. They test everything over there. It's a really phenomenal resource. So yes, we'll definitely give you more information about that.
All right. Next up, I wanted to talk about, oh yes, here we go. Anne from Medford, Oregon writes to us. I have a Japanese maple that is likely 20 years old. I'm not certain of the variety. We live in USDA Zone 8B, Sunset Zone 7. Now, this Japanese maple is placed in a southeast-facing area on the top of a hill with very clay soil. The previous owners replaced a lawn with about a foot of 1-inch rock that is pale gray. Mm. It appears to be planted at a good height as the root crown is above the rock, and we have pulled most of the awful weed matting away from the base and dripping of the tree. The soil in our yard appears to contain moisture about an inch below the surface, even in the heat of summer. We have two emitters at a drip line that was placed by the previous owners, and we run them every day for 20 minutes. So let's think about that. The drip line of the tree, this is a huge tree.
It's a beautiful picture. The line of the tree,
and there's one emitter on each side, and that's it.
Yeah.
Both my husband and I agree, and this is rare when it comes to water, that they are likely not helpful. That is the two drips. He thinks there is sufficient moisture, and I believe that in the summer, this tree needs a drink twice a month for several hours on drip. The tree appears to be healthy, but I think it gets stressed when our temperatures are above 95 degrees for weeks on end. Typically, our winters provide adequate water. What is your recommendation for watering in this situation? Can we turn the emitters off and just water with a hose periodically? It's difficult to put this tree on its own watering zone. Mm-hmm. We do not fertilize at all and don't plan to. We do not know what the lifespan of the tree is, but we adore it and want to keep it forever as it is visually pleasing. We enjoy the bee activity in the spring, and it provides our living room with lovely light in the winter and dappled shade in the summer. And here are pictures. And the pictures are incredible.
Yes, you've touched my heart. I am an absolute lover of Japanese maples. I actually have 18 of them. And it's one of my favorite species of trees. And we're in a climate where it's a little stressful and challenging for them. So I've gone to a lot of effort to get irrigation, distributing well, and taking care of these trees that I have here in the Sacramento Valley. Our average high temperature in July being 93. Of course, we have episodes where we go up to as high as 111 or higher at times, and it's very low humidity. So we obviously have to water them here. Medford is a more moist climate, but there's a couple things about this that do concern me. One is that the previous owners took out a lawn and replaced it with gravel. That doesn't thrill me right there, but because gravel reflects heat. Here in the valley, if you put in a gravel mulch, you've increased the air temperature in that zone like 10 degrees. It's really quite uncomfortable. Medford is, for those of you not familiar with it, it's the center part of Oregon, Willamette Valley. It's a lovely area. It is hot, but not hot like here, Sacramento Valley hot. I remember leaving the Sacramento Valley once for one of our annual vacations up into Oregon. We arrived in somewhere near Medford, and they were having a heat wave because they were in the 90s. And someone that, you know, the nice lady at the restaurant said, "You ought to come back when we aren't having a heat wave." And we just smothered our laughter. So what exactly, what do you think it's like where we came here from? But it is hot at times in Medford, and you guys have been having a heat wave just like we've been having a heat wave. My concern is taking out that lawn. That tree, which is an established roughly 20 by 20 foot Japanese maple, its root system was relying on lawn irrigation before they did that. And it's a well-branched, extensive network of roots. It goes well past the drip line of the tree, or it did anyway. And presumably they're still there since the tree looks pretty darn healthy. You probably do have sufficient soil moisture most summers to get through the summer, but it would be optimal to give it some more irrigation. I think you're both right in this case. He is correct that the rainfall and stuff is probably almost sufficient, but when you have extreme heat, and I believe you've been having some extreme heat just as we have, an extra irrigation or some maybe once a month or every couple of weeks would be better. But two emitters aren't doing anything. Correct. They're pointless. There's a system that was devised by a cooperative extension gentleman here at Davis, Lauren Oakey, where he was recommending that if people take out turf, they put in a really simplified drip irrigation system to replace the portion of the lawn watering that was going to the tree. And it involves simply three rings of drip, one fairly close to the trunk, one about on the drip line of the tree. For those who are uninitiated, drip line is if rain was falling down onto the tree, where would it drip to? From the leaves of the tree. So that circle, the shadow pattern of the tree, basically. And one further one out past the drip line, because the roots of trees do go easily 50% out beyond the drip line of the tree. Can be a lot more than that in some soils in some areas. So when you're watering, you want to water that whole zone. And his system was just three rings. No, it's not perfect, but it was getting people through our two major droughts over the last 15 years. And they would run it long enough to water to a depth of 18 inches. That was his recommendation. It's also a fairly standard recommendation we encounter from arborists with good training on this. If you water to a depth of 18 inches, you know, 24 inches might be better, but at least 18 inches, which you can measure in a variety of fairly primitive ways, 18-inch screwdriver, long bamboo pole stuck in the ground the next day, then you're almost sure to get the whole root zone adequately hydrated. Distribution that way will take care of having lost the lawn watering. There's another simple way to do it. Sprinkler on a hose once a month. I do this all the time on my property. I'm a firm believer in redundancy of irrigation. That's going to become another one of our Davis Garden Show aphorisms. I'm a firm believer in redundancy in irrigation. Your drip line may be great, but it's never perfect during extreme heat. Maybe just setting a sprinkler out there will take care of the problems with the drip line, even when you've installed one specifically for this purpose. It isn't a bad idea to distribute more effectively. Sprinklers have a drawback. They put out water so rapidly that in soils that have any clay content like yours and like many of those in our area, it can only absorb a quarter to a half inch of water at a time, and you need to be applying 1 to 1.5 inches total. That was a lot of numbers. We can come back to that if you want. The point being, it'll puddle and run off before it soaks in. And so you're not effectively watering if you set a sprinkler out there and let it just run as long as, you know, you would really need, because it'll puddle and run off. You have a slope. It'll run downhill and it won't get to where it's needed. So you break it up. You set it out there, you run it until it puddles, which is a useful data point right there. Let that soak in, run it again until it puddles, let that soak in. Do that a few times. If you want to measure, I'd like to see you putting on an inch and a half measured in a cylinder of water all at once. 2 inches would be great. And you could go easily in clay soils, especially. You should be able to go at least a couple of weeks before you need to do that again, because a disadvantage of clay soils, water penetrates poorly, poor infiltration rate. But an advantage, once you hydrate them, they retain moisture. So clay and clay loam soils have some advantages. If you water effectively, efficiently, and thoroughly, you can go a pretty long interval before you have to water again. Even in the Davis area, we have a wide variance in this. I have customers in Stonegate or Binning Tract, which are parts of town, have a high clay content to their soil. They have to break their watering up into cycles. Lois, by comparison, lives in an area with some of the finest sandy loam soil in the entire world. She could probably set a hose out there at a moderate flow, and it would just run and soak in for hours. The drawback to that is she has to water more often. The advantage is she doesn't get runoff, so water doesn't get wasted. So with your clay-ish soil, sprinklers set, like one of those oscillating sprinklers, the kind kids like to play in, run long enough to do an inch and a half of water would probably be a great thing to do for that tree every couple weeks, every 4 weeks, something like that. But a simple drip system would just be something that would make rings around the tree, run long enough to get into a depth of 18 inches. You wouldn't have to do that all the time because you don't get as hot and dry as we do, but you don't get rainfall in the summer, and Japanese maples do prefer that. Again, though, major Davis Garden Show aphorism, plant performance is your best guide to whether your irrigation system is working correctly. So if the tree looks good and you don't have signs of stress like scorched leaves or lack of new growth or anything like that, then you may be fine just using a sprinkler on a hose and supplementing whatever it's getting otherwise. I do think the two drippers are pointless. If you're going to have a drip system on there, it might as well be more efficient and more effective. Beautiful picture, by the way. My only concern here is that they've replaced something that was providing the tree with water with a whole vast area where there is no water being applied to the tree. You probably should compensate for that somehow.
I noticed that the tree is fairly close to the house. Mm-hmm. My guess is that the drip line is right near where the roof is. Looking at your pictures, at least that's my assumption. So if you were going to do the three circles, like Don is suggesting, you probably want to skip that portion of it underneath your house.
Yeah, it doesn't. And good news, roots typically don't go under houses, at least not here, because there's no moisture there. You can see, just looking at one of these pictures, the shadow pattern the tree is creating is kind of telling you where to run your drip line. And that would give you an opportunity, by the way, to plant some nice soil shading ground covers. So one thing that would benefit this tree, I think, in the long run, since they took away something that was cooling the soil and something that was providing moisture just because it was turf, replacing that, at least in part, with a ground cover that would cast shadow over the gravel would be probably an improvement both aesthetically and in terms of the protection of the root system. It could be a much lower water ground cover than turf. There's lots and lots of choices that you could do there that'll vary. Obviously, you're in Medford. We'd probably have a different list here in the Sacramento Valley. There are native plants that would work, native to your region. There are grasses that would work if you like that kind of an informal meadow look. But I would get something planted out there. And an advantage that would have is that you'd be irrigating those new plants, and you'd be irrigating an expanding zone more or less around the tree, and you'd be irrigating the tree's roots at the same time. So one of the things that we're doing in Tree Davis, an organization I'm very active in, is planting landscapes in and around some of the trees we're planting to show the public, these are in public areas where they can see them, that there can be relatively low water choices planted nearby the trees that then themselves get irrigated. I say low water, but not no water, low water choices, or can be native, they can be non-native, a mix of the above, things for pollinators, all kinds of choices. But we have found that when we do that, the volunteers that come in are carefully weeding through there and nurturing those things. They're spreading mulch in the bare areas because they want to see that soil shaded. In other words, it causes the people, the caretakers, to give more attention to the zone as well. And it has the effect of us, or in the case of Tree Davis working with the city, expanding the irrigation not just for the tree, but for the plants around it, which is good for the tree. So landscaping around the tree, not in a way that competes with it. You don't plant right up next to the trunk or anything like that, but you plant ground covers that cast shadow over the surface. You have things that help to shade and conserve some moisture. You're watering those plants, which is beneficial. And they can also just be fun things that draw pollinators, so or other wildlife. So there's lots of things you can do to make that better for the tree. More to the point, it would enhance the irrigation that you're providing.
And if you really like the look of the tree isolated out there like it is right now, and it looks very beautiful.
Yes, indeed.
You could just leave the rocks as they are and water a little more. The question I would have is, the previous owners, you say, took out the lawn and put in the rocks. Did they do that, you know, a year ago or 5 years ago or what? Because it might be that this tree is fine with the rocks.
Could be.
They're not so light colored that they're reflecting lots of light. Don, what if they weren't rocks? What if this was wood chips? Would you have a different opinion then?
Yes, chips are better than rock. Mulch compost is better than chips. A mix of chips and mulch compost has become a popular combination because the compost works into the soil and improves the health of the soil, whereas the bark just shades it. All that rock does is shade the soil. It doesn't obviously break down into anything of benefit to the tree. So we like to see the soil enhanced. We like to see the soil flora, the soil biota, the things that live in the soil encouraged, and rock doesn't encourage them. Bark marginally does, compost definitely does. So one simple thing would be to just get some more compost out there. But overall, again, the tree looks healthy. So this is the first thing. This is not like the pictures I'm looking at here in the Sacramento Valley that people are sending me right now. So again, performance of the plant, I would say, is your best guide. You don't need to fertilize. It doesn't appear to have any deficiencies that I can see. And just for the record, maples can live for many, 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 many years, decades, if not hundreds of years. So I don't see any problem there. And I think you're doing all the right things. You're concerned about the irrigation, particularly in periods of high temperature or stress. And you just should probably supplement the irrigation, but not nearly as much as would be necessary here in our very dry, hot Sacramento Valley.
Thank you for writing, and thank you for sending such beautiful pictures.
Yes, I'm very jealous. I'm very jealous of your Japanese maple.
Anytime any listeners want to send us pictures of their beautiful trees, feel free to. Mm-hmm. And you can send it. Where do they send it, Don?
DavisGardenShow@gmail.com.
So we have another email message, and this is from Chuck in Carmichael, California. Hi, Don and Lois. I have a few questions I'm hoping you can help me with. One is a follow-up question regarding my dogwood trees. Thank you very much for answering my previous question about what might have been causing them to struggle. You mentioned it may have been Phytophthora caused by our heavy rains that winter. Is that? Mm-hmm. I don't think you said that.
Phytophthora would be related to heavy soil moisture. Yeah.
In the winter. Okay.
Well, carrying in the winter into the spring, into the late spring. I mean, what I mean is when Phytophthora is, let me stop right here. Phytophthora is mostly a problem when we get late rains, heavy rainfall in the winter, saturated soil, then rain in April or May, continuing as the weather warms up, and then the Phytophthora attacks. Most commonly, it's even worse when people suddenly turn on their sprinklers after it's been raining in early May, and then it warms up in mid-May, and they go, oh, I need to turn on the sprinklers, and they start watering too often. But I remember this.
Phytophthora needs water and heat together.
Right.
Okay, got it. All right. I took your suggestion to give them another season to see if they bounce back at all. They didn't.
Oh, okay.
And with a heavy heart, I removed them in June of this year. Aw, that's so sad. My question is, can I plant another tree in that spot this fall? I am thinking about planting a saucer magnolia in its place.
Okay, let's start with that first. Yes, you can. When you've had a problem with Phytophthora, it's ubiquitous. I mean, I remember my plant path professor saying, just assume it's everywhere. It's not native here, but we sure brought it in, and it's everywhere. The only place you wouldn't find Phytophthora cinnamomei is in totally undisturbed wildland areas, and it's important to keep it out of those. You can plant in the same place Phytophthora attacks a plant because of the environmental conditions. It's not just the presence of the pathogen. It's not just the type of host. It's the fact that that host, under those conditions, with soil moisture that reached a certain temperature, got infected. Usually it's because of saturated soil, like heavy clay soil, which we'll get to in a moment. So you can replant in the same spot. Just make some change so that water always percolates away from the crown of the plant, no matter what you put in there. And that's an important thing for folks in the Davis area to do, and any place else where you have high clay content in your soil. You want water to not stand or pool around the plant. You always want it to, when there's an excess, to drain away, whether it's winter or summer. We want it to percolate away, even just to a point a couple feet away. We once saved a customer's cherry tree because the neighbors were watering and the water was flowing into their yard and they couldn't get the neighbor to stop watering. That's one of the hardest things to do, get your neighbor to change their irrigation pattern. They just won't do it. So every time the neighbor watered, water was flooding in under the fence and standing around their cherry tree. Cherries are very intolerant of saturated soil, very prone to crown and root rot. So we didn't have a way to change the grade of the existing plant. It was already established. So all we could do was redirect the water. We took a post hole digger. We went a few feet from the trunk. We dug down as far as that post hole digger would go, which is about 3.5 feet. It makes about a 6 or 8 inch diameter pit. And we backfilled that with coarse gravel. That one little spot. So anytime the neighbor watered, it flowed towards the cherry tree, then over to the little sump pit that we had created. And it always drained away from the crown of the tree, and it saved the tree. So the neighbor was now just thoughtfully watering the cherry tree, but not in such a way that it would kill the cherry tree. It was really a simple matter of redirecting where the water flowed, and especially where it stood when there was an excess. So that's the key principle to keep in mind as we move to the next part of your question.
So from what you just said, I would hear you say, make a little mound to plant whatever it is on.
Yes,
so that when you're planting a new thing, you might as well raise it up a little.
And more than just a little, just because it will settle. So a few inches can make a big difference. You know, a slight 6 inch mound and it's going to settle a couple inches. Water will still percolate away from the crown of the tree. And you can do that by taking native existing soil from nearby. I mean, you can just, one thing you can do is just sort of make a trench further out, take the soil from the trench and pile it up where you're going to plant. So water always goes away. Yeah, okay, if it goes into the trench, fine. That may be an efficient way to water the tree in the long run, but it gets it away from the crown of the plant.
Okay, and then a saucer magnolia, is this a plant that has any of those VFN numbers or anything like that?
Magnolias? No, the saucer magnolia, I assume he's referring to Magnolia soulangeana, which is sometimes called tulip tree. It's a beautiful flowering tree that blooms very, very early. When they bloom here, it's practically right as or after the almonds are blooming. We get a lot of questions about them at that time. The big flowers all at once for about 2 weeks, and then the plant puts out these light green leaves, and that's it. That's all you get is that early bloom, but it's spectacular when it's in bloom. They don't like extremely hot conditions, and they do need a lot of moisture. So they're not a drought-tolerant tree, and they are, in my opinion, best where they're lightly shaded by another tree. If this spot would have shade from the house or something like that, that might be fine. I have had problems in my own here when we planted one years ago. It grew fine, it bloomed fine, but it always scorched on the west side because I hadn't sheltered it from the west. So the tree looked a little unsightly by the end of the summer. You know what? It was perfectly healthy. It grew fine. I have many pictures of the blossoms when it was in full bloom, but the west side of the tree always looked a little sunburned. So it would probably be best as an understory tree rather than something right out in full sun. Having said that, with adequate irrigation, it probably will do well. But again, it needs to be crowned up a bit, like we were talking about a few minutes ago.
Okay. And Chuck continues. I want to try to improve the soil around that area. Good. I plan to aerate the lawn to relieve compaction in my heavy clay soil. Do you recommend spreading sand or topsoil over the area after aerating? I want to improve the soil and its drainage and level the lawn as it is quite lumpy. I also plan on overseeding the lawn while I'm at it. I remember you had a terrific two-part episode on turf grass and overseeding, but when I went back to listen, I saw your old podcasts had been removed. Oh, no. Is there a way I can still listen to your old shows? Your show is something I look forward to every week. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's do the last part first. Podcast gone?
What's on the davisgardenshow.com page right now is only the shows from 2024. We had to move our server to another server, and that's what I built for the page there. I will go find those, and my plan has been to go in and find individual shows that are real special focus like that and provide easily accessible links to those. So you don't have to scroll through several hundred episodes to find the one you're after there. I will do that. I will find it. Maybe even by the time this airs, who knows, it might be there. More to the point, all of those shows are at catered.org. We're talking about davisgardenshow.com. There's two different ways you all get podcasts out there, and I don't know who's listening to which one. The longest established method was davisgardenshow.com, and that's the link for that podcast that many people signed up for. But it also is possible to go to kdrt.org, go to the Davis Garden Show page, click on the RSS feed there, and that's the podcast. And those are all there in the archives at kdirt.org, all the way back to 2005. They're in there. They may or may not say the one about turf grass. So I'll try to find that one and make sure that gets up where you can get at it, because it'll be very timely in just a few weeks as we get closer to turf season. So that will be there, but I appreciate your comment. And yes, if you go to davisgardenshow.com, you'll find it's rather stripped down at the moment. All right, well, I will try to find that one. I believe the key question here is spreading sand or topsoil. No, the best thing to spread over your lawn after aerating is compost. The very best things you can do. You want something coarser. Sand, interesting. Sand is used in turf, in sporting turf. I mean, so if you read about how they do lawns for Wimbledon tennis courts or for putting greens, they will spread sand over in for various reasons. It has some issues with clay. If you spread sand in a soil that's got a lot of clay content, an interesting phenomenon, it can interlock and make a somewhat impermeable layer, and that can become a challenge. Whereas in golf courses, that's not happening because they don't have those kinds of soils. They've constructed the soils there. It is better to take something fairly coarse, like any good quality compost you can purchase, bags of it, whatever. And you can go ahead and spread that out. And after you've aerated, we would rake up the little aeration plugs at first when we used to do this for people, and we found that was an extraordinary amount of labor and really didn't make that much difference. So you're going out and renting a device, pulls up little plugs of soil so the water will penetrate at least in that spot where the little hole has been made. And you would leave the plugs on. We would rake them up. Again, that just seemed like an excessive labor. So what we found was we would get a couple yards of compost delivered, and right after aerating, we would frequently go ahead and fertilize the lawn. We would then, if we were going to seed it, scatter a good blend of seed, and then we would top dress with a surprising amount of the compost, as much as a quarter to half an inch, and rake that in so that the existing grass kind of popped up through it a little bit. Don't worry too much about that, by the way. The grass will push through a quarter inch or a half inch layer of compost without any problem. And that would filter down into those holes that were made by the sod corer and enhance the water infiltration rate of your lawn. So rather than topsoil you would use if you really need to fill a low spot and change the grade. That is one reason for using it, or sometimes sand, is if you've got a real low area that's a few inches across and it's maybe an inch lower and you're concerned about a tripping hazard or something, you can take sand or topsoil, rake some into that particular low area, maybe a half inch at a time, water it in, let the grass grow through it, do that again. You can adjust your grade very locally at a small scale by doing that. It's hard to change the grade of the whole lawn that way, but in terms of improving water penetration and for the better quality of your turf, compost will make more difference than topsoil or sand.
The next thing is starting Lois's saga. Now, y'all know that I have declined in my outdoor activity, and I'm not being as on things.
Wait. Don't say declined. Change is a good thing.
Yeah.
It is a negative thing.
Not in this case, Don. I can't do what I used to do. None of us can, yeah. So I've hired a person to help me in the yard, and that's really good. But I have decided that underneath the plum tree now, and right now the plums are ripe, And I've put tarps down so that whatever falls to the ground will fall on a tarp and people can, it'll be cleaner in that way. But once the plums are gone, I'm going to cover that entire area with, 4 to 6 inches of arborist wood chips.
Yep.
And so this is the saga. In May, I got lots of weeds removed with this gardener's help around the plum tree, and I decided to put down a thick layer of arborist wood chips to keep the weeds away next year, and Don agreed with that. He said, that's a good plan.
So this is my seal of approval.
I did a little research, and I found a website called chipdrop.com, and yes, that is the website. And when you go in there, they say, are you an arborist or are you a gardener? And you sign up differently. So I signed up as a gardener. And chip drops are free to gardeners and are $20 a drop for arborists. So the arborist has had a tree, they've chopped its stuff up, and they're going to bring it over to your house and drop it. They do accept donations, by the way, if you want to help fund whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so July 3rd. I made a request at the chip drop, and the request, I encourage you to go there and listen and watch that little video they've got. It's so funny and it's so, so useful. When you make a request, you've got three choices. You can say, I only want wood chips, or you can say, I only want logs, or you can say, I'll take a mixture of both. Mm. And when we're talking logs, logs can be anything from tree trunks that are the size of your thigh or bigger, all the way up to logs that when they're laying down, they're waist high. I mean, So anyway, you make a request, what you want. I said wood chips only. And then they say, where do you want us to put it? They ask you for a picture if you have one. I told them in the driveway on the right side if possible. But it's going to be wide enough that I think if the car were on the left side of the driveway and they came and dropped chip drops, I'd have a problem. So my car is now parked in the street.
And
they
said,
put something down on the ground where you want the chips to be. So there's a cardboard out there that says chips here. And I'm holding it down with a little brick. And we don't know when they're coming. They could have come that afternoon. They didn't. Mm-hmm. They could be here this, today or a week from today or 2 weeks from today. Deliveries made whenever the arborist in the area has some stuff to drop and they want to go to your house. Their choice. How much am I going to get? Well, as little as 4 cubic yards, which I'm told would be like a half a pickup truck load or something like that, up to 20 cubic yards, which is one of those big dump truck things. And they'll just show up.
Yeah.
So yeah. I will keep you informed as to what's going on when we get to having the chip drops. But 4 cubic yards to 20 cubic yards, that's a lot of difference. And Don, how many wheelbarrows will it take me to move 4 cubic yards? Let's just do the 4 cubic yards.
Yeah, well, a cubic yard is 27 cubic feet. Most contractors' wheelbarrows are 3 cubic feet. If you fill them full,
mine is 2 yards.
Well, and most people actually will find it easier to do about 2 cubic feet at a time. So that means you've got, let's say, 13 to 14 wheelbarrow loads per yard, and you're getting 4 yards. So that's 50 or so wheelbarrow loads. When I was a landscape contractor, one of the things I had to estimate was, how much time is it going to take a person to move a giant pile of bark from the driveway to the newly landscaped area? It takes longer than you think. But yes, it's going to be a dozen or so wheelbarrow loads per yard. And so 4 yards would be 65 or 70 wheelbarrow loads. So 15 or 20 yards is a lot. It's a lot of moving. It's not hard moving. It doesn't require any great horticultural skill. And with respect to spreading out arborist wood chips, it doesn't matter how deep you go. I mean, you can put them 12 inches deep. If you've got too much, fine. They'll just break down over time. Don't bury plants that you care about. Okay. Mm-hmm. So if you have some herbaceous perennials in there and you put 6 inches of wood chips on top of them, that may be the last time you see those herbaceous perennials. Mm-hmm. But you can spread it all around all the shrubs, all the trees around the herbaceous perennials. When we would do bark as the last step of landscaping, we'd just dump it and another person was raking it. And then the last step of the process was taking a rake and raking it away a little bit from individual plants. We were concerned that the bark up against the trunk of a shrub or a tree would trap moisture and could lead to phytophthora concerns. I've gone back and forth about this with one of the major proponents of arborist wood chips, Dr. Linda Chalker Scott. We've mentioned her many times, Washington State University, who believes this is one of the best things you can do to your yard. You can control weeds, you can walk on it, and it builds the soil at a rate that's appropriate to your soil. So you put, it's, for one thing, it's wet. It's wet wood. It may not seem wet like soggy, but it's not like bark. And it's not like dry sawdust or shavings. It's actually something that's just been ground up, usually shortly before you receive it. And it was a tree at one point. So unless it was a completely dead tree, you've got some moisture in there. You spread that out on the surface. We would rake it away a little bit. We would then wash off everything just because it looks better and gets the dust to settle. And that little bit of extra moisture and the fact that it's a wood that's wet means it'll immediately get colonized by soil bacteria and fungus that will move right on up in there. Earthworms will go up and down and up and down into this new cover. And it'll immediately start improving the soil microbial activity. It'll shade the soil. It'll retain moisture. And the other question I sometimes get, well, doesn't it become a fire hazard? Well, it's wet. So the answer is no, it basically does not become a fire hazard. I was able to find some studies on different mulches and how they dry out. And over many months, if it were completely dry and free of rainfall, the surface of your arborist wood chips might get dry. But literally once every 6 to 8 weeks, a brief overhead watering would actually take care of that if it was even necessary to do that. And it's probably not, because it is actually pulling up moisture from the, you know, moisture is moving in from the soil below. So in every respect, it's good for the soil and it's hard to overdo it. The only thing would be don't completely bury a plant you care about. But other than that, if you've got extra, if you've done all your mulch around your plum and all the nearby shrubs and under your xylostoma and all around everything else, you've still got a heap of it out there. Aside from putting a little sign on it that says to your neighbors, free, help yourselves. Yeah. The other option is to just pile some of that up in one side of your backyard, just to heap it up in one area. And let's say you're dealing with ornamental strawberry or some other really vigorous ground cover that's just one of those nuisance ground covers. Every time you see one, bury it. Just take some more shovels full, bury it. And you could actually suppress many, many weeds. Dr. Chalker Scott has even controlled woody weed plants. She's up in Washington where woody plants are your major weed issues. Cut, bury, cut, bury, cut, bury. And you can actually get surprisingly good control of even difficult to control weeds while you're building the soil. The one problem would be if you have landscape fabric under there, it's not going to integrate with the soil. So it'd be best if you can get that fabric out of those areas or break through it somehow. But even still, even if you can't do that, you're at least shading the soil and retaining moisture. So this is the other question that I sometimes get, aside from the fire hazard issue, what about nitrogen? What about that issue where if you turn this stuff into the soil, it would tie up nitrogen as it breaks down. So if you tried to plant a tree into that after mixing it in the soil, the tree would just sit there and not grow because of lack of nitrogen. The only place where you'd get a measurable deficiency of nitrogen from a big heap of wood chips on the soil is right at that interface of that the wood chips in the soil. The roots are well below that. They're in the native soil. So it does not have any material impact on the nitrogen content of the soil that matters to the plant. It's actually a really effective way to slowly feed the soil by the breakdown of that organic material. Organic material contains macronutrients and micronutrients to some degree. But if you turn them in, they have to decompose and go through a process of decomposition before the nitrogen or the phosphorus or potassium are available to the plant. We just put it on the surface. It happens at a rate that's determined by the microbial activity of your soil, the temperature, and the moisture. So basically, at the rate that's appropriate, that would be naturally occurring. And it really doesn't harm plants that are there in any way. And then the third question we sometimes get, and you can get this information answered, I suspect, at the site, what about disease problems or pest problems? As far as Dr. Chalker Scott is concerned, there has never been evidence of disease spreading from ground-up trees to a new landscape. I do know that in the coastal zones, if you're listening over in the sudden oak death territory of California, which is the fog belt of Northern California, basically Sunset Zone 17, there were immediately upon sudden oak death 30 years ago coming into the state, there were immediately restrictions put on the movement of firewood, compost of this sort, and so forth because of that concern. There's no evidence that it actually was a risk. Okay. But it was a precaution that was taken at the time and is still implemented. You go into campgrounds over there, it'll tell you, you know, don't move firewood from one place to another. There's no evidence, but just as a, you know, just as a general precaution, the concern was that it could be a problem and they didn't know that much about that particular disease at the time. So if you're listening to us in Berkeley or anywhere right in that, you know, where you can see or smell the ocean, as we say, then you might have an issue with the movement of products like this because of the possible risk of contamination with this one particular narrow disease problem. In general, overall, no evidence of disease problems. Things like mistletoe, nope, that's just been ground up. Don't worry about it. It's part of the mulch now. And as far as pests go, again, they're not typically going to convey with a ground product like this. Moving firewood could be much more of an issue, honestly, than moving it ground up. I'd be more concerned about moving an invasive borer or something like that on the logs than in the ground product that you're getting.
And if I look at our email, I see Arvin has written to us. He's located in Folsom. I'm a regular listener of your show. Thank you very much for the wonderful program and the fantastic information. I'm located in Folsom, California. With the recent heat wave in Sacramento County, my Fuyu persimmon tree shows a lot of sunburn on its leaves. The tree has been planted in the same location for about 4 years now and gets full afternoon sun. The watering schedule has not changed, except that I did water more frequently in the last week because of the heat wave. I have attached some pictures. Please advise.
These are great pictures, and this is really a common conversation we're having right now at our nursery. Good news is your tree looks healthy, and this is classic sunburn. Yes, the leaf, part of the leaf facing to the west got scorched, generally correlates with inadequate soil moisture. So I would look at the distribution of water, which is turning out to be more important in many of our conversations really than anything else. You know, they're using drip and it's not covering as well as we would hope. Most problems with drip systems, we're going to do a whole bunch of our Redwood Barn, or excuse me, of our Davis Garden Show aphorisms today. Most problems with drip systems can be solved by running them longer, okay, because the water will spread out thanks to capillary action. Probably, as we went right into that extreme heat, a longer soak rather than a more frequent soak would have made a difference. What I was doing for 5 days prior to that extreme heat of last Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I have 42 valves on my farm. I can run them 6 to 8 at a time. Each group of valves was running for 8 to 12 hours for drip systems that are watering woody plants, trees and shrubs, orchard and otherwise. And that was giving them, in my what I've calculated and also double checked, a watering to a depth of about 18 to 24 inches. And that was all I did. I just gave them a very thorough soaking going into the heat wave rather than light, shallow waterings, you know, light, frequent waterings. I do a very long soak beforehand. And that has worked for me. But I'll tell you, my persimmon tree on the west side, some of the leaves are sunburned. Okay. That was an extreme heat event. And good news is it's just a cosmetic thing. It's not hurting the plant all that much. But it does tell you and tell me that I probably hadn't given that tree enough water throughout its whole root zone necessarily. I was watering with the system I've been using for a long time. And it might not be covering far out enough, or, you know, as far as in the drip line as the tree is now, or past the drip line as the tree roots are now progressed. An extra cycle might have helped. A longer cycle might have helped. As I say, we're coming out of this heat wave. The damage is done. The tree looks basically healthy. And I think it just is a reminder that monitoring the ET rate, if that's the kind of engineering approach you like to do, using your instinct, it's going to be really hot for a few days. Water longer, not more often, water longer if you possibly can. That's usually the best way to go if your soil will allow that.
But Don, I mean, some trees just can't take it.
Yeah,
and, they're going to scorch no matter what you do.
Yeah, there's
I don't care how much you water a Japanese maple. You put it in the sun, it's going to crinkle up.
Many will, yes. They vary somewhat, but there are some species of trees that we don't recommend here. because they won't take the dry heat that we have. And there are some species that we grow because we love them, because they're Japanese maples or persimmons, and they're from rainier climates. And so we either adjust the irrigation. This is where the landscape coefficient part of the engineering discussion comes in. Persimmon needs more water to grow, flourish, and look good than certain other fruit trees. However, they're drought tolerant. They're drought survivors. If they get drought stressed, they'll burn. The leaves will burn. The trees, basically, its health and productivity is probably not compromised all that much. Your Japanese maple, in full sun, drought stressed, not only will the leaves burn, a lot of them will fall off. And at that point, the interior bark will be exposed to direct sun. That will cause sunburn. Sunburn on the interior of a Japanese maple is likely to lead to borers. That's the beginning of the end for that tree, typically. So it matters more for some trees than others. I definitely have been watering my Japanese maple border, of which I have a long border, Japanese maple, and there's a type of dogwood in there, and some other high water trees. They're all zoned for that. I've run that twice during the course of this high temperature event, whereas almost everything else, one deep soaking was adequate. So as we've been trying to get people to water once a week, you know, and some things less than that, but once a week. If I could get more of you watering the woody plants on your property, thorough soaking once a week all through our irrigation season, health and vigor of the trees would be better. This is a case where running it longer once a week would probably have been fine. But for a lot of people, that was challenging, going in resetting their timer. So I said, all right, just have it run a whole nother cycle if that's easiest for you. Or hand water. I'm a firm believer in redundancy of irrigation systems. You know, I've got a little sprinkler that's moving around right now as we're recording the show. It's sitting at the base of my ginkgo at the moment, giving it a really good soaking and so forth. Individual trees are getting a little bit more attention because of the extreme heat and the higher water use that we're experiencing. I think your tree's fine. Mine looks a lot like it. So I'm, you know, you'll be happy to know that my healthy 30-foot Fuyu persimmon has just about as much sunburn as yours from the looks of it. I know the tree's fine. I know it's going to be okay. I'm not going to have any shortage of persimmons, that's for sure. And so I'm not real concerned about that. But this is where that, you know, if you're really interested in figuring it all out, the landscape coefficient of a persimmon is going to be higher than a lot of other fruit trees would be. They're tough trees, but that scorch is an indication that the waxy leaf coating probably got a little thin during a period, and that happens from light drought stress, and probably that's where that sunburn is coming from. Great picture, and I may use that one as a sample. So thank you very much for that.
All right, we have a message here from Kathy, and she writes, "Dear Don and Lois, thanks for your show. We listen to your podcast on long car rides. Mm. It's very enjoyable distraction from boring drives."
There you go.
"This summer, we've grown a cucumber that I highly recommend. It's called Summer Dance Hybrid. It is a standard green cucumber that so far has stayed sweet with no bitterness. It is crunchy and tasty and easier to peel than lemon cucumbers. We're still waiting for a ripe tomato. Thank you, Kathy, for that report."
The Summer Dancer is a great one. Thanks for the feedback.
So I am going to close this show with a wonderful email that we got from Jane. And she's a longtime listener and writes in occasionally. And she says, "Dear Lois, when you ended the last program with a garden quote, I thought you were going to say the one I embroidered recently, as was very similar. Here's a photo of yet another quote from the well-known author, Anonymous." And the quote is, "Whoever plants a garden feels he has done something for the good of the world."
Positive, uplifting garden commentary. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
There is some great programming here at KDRT, and you'll find the Yolo County Breakdown with DJ Rocky Outcrop live Fridays, 10 to 11 a.m. From Bill Monroe to Billy Strings, the Yolo County Breakdown is a journey through bluegrass and newgrass music, acoustic string music, and the spirit of American roots and country that was born through the genius of Bill Monroe and his bluegrass boys, but which has spread and flowered to be an art form that is uniquely American. Listen to what he's spinning on KDRT Fridays, 10 to 11.